Hey everyone, my name is Joe, and you are listening to One Word of Advice. Growing up, Ned always had a strong interest in figuring out how things work. This inner curiosity led him to start his first e-commerce business at the age of 21, before venturing into photography and digital media business at the age of 25. However, just when things were working well for him, he was struck with a life-threatening illness which put his business and all his plans to a halt. In this episode, Ned shares on the struggles and triumphs of being an entrepreneur, his revelations on life gained during the recovery process, as well as the decision to transit back into corporate life. So I interviewed my friend in the last podcast, and we talked about leaving our first job. After that, I got into a traineeship with a huge tech company as a way to upskill myself. I never imagined myself to be here, but now that because I'm here, I get to meet lots of fellow trainees, all of whom have very diverse backgrounds and stories. I think it's so interesting to me that everyone is all doing different things, but we are now all here in the same place, all with the same goal of learning. So when I first met you, all I thought was that, wow, you know, this person is really interesting. And also because you were like, you know, networking with everyone and everyone know who Ned is. And I remember back then you mentioned that you were doing freelance for a very long time. So I was very curious because that seems like a huge jump to me from the freelance to the corporate world. So I really wanted to hear a story.
Sure. I guess there's different ways to describe it, right? Mm-hmm. You can say freelance, you can say self-employed, you can say entrepreneur. I think end of the day, it's just a label. Mm-hmm. Of course, ultimately, depending on who you're speaking with and what your goals are, you might find, you might want to change that branding differently. Yeah, but to answer your question, I think maybe, and to also help me structure my responses in a way that's a bit more beneficial for today, like, you know, which aspect of my journey would be most interesting to you?
Maybe you want to introduce your journey a bit, because I knew that you were in photography for quite some time, and then I knew you set up a business around it, and you did some digital marketing too. But how was it like? What did you dabble in as well?
Yeah, so maybe I'll start with the background. So,
it's a long story.
It's a long story, but I think the pieces would make sense once you join the dots together. So growing up, I've always had a fascination with machines, tinkering around with stuff, playing Lego, playing with the TV remote control buttons, learning how to fix electronic things. Not so much just fixing things, but just figuring out how things work in general. Like, I can be sitting in a car and like playing with the buttons that control the different windows and all that. And then being observant about my surroundings, like, you know, how does the taxi driver shift the gears? Back then, where taxis were still like manual transmission, right? So that kind of thing is things I just enjoyed. So as I grew older, I somehow guess I developed a natural affinity for maths and physics, which led me to pursue an engineering degree. Also because I think one of the reasons why I chose that major in university was I was thinking, do I need a business degree to do business, right? And the answer was no, because I had already started my own first business back then.
When you were in university?
Before I started university.
So
what happened was I was fresh out of army. Then my good friend and I were just thinking, like, you know, instead of like sitting around and waiting 6 months to start college, why don't we start something online, like start selling shoes online? Right, so my business partner / good friend's expertise was he had access to a supply chain.
Okay.
So basically, his uncle owned a shoe shop. Right. So, you know, that's how he was able to get the goods.
Okay.
And I provided the marketing aspect of it. So this was for context, right? So this happened back in 2007. In 2007, the digital ecosystem was very different. It's not like what you see today. Back then, there was no payment gateway, no online payments gateway. 2007 was the same time as PayPal was just starting out. The internet landscape back then was still very focused around people writing blogs online. I think Xia Xie was just getting still started. Still in the early days, right? So this was early days, and that was just the setting back then. So one of the platforms that we used to sort of sell these shoes online was stuff like, of course, we had our own website, which I helped to build from scratch. But at the same time, to amplify our efforts and to amplify our reach, we use things like Yahoo Auctions, which is no longer around today. We use eBay, which is still around, thankfully. Yeah, so these were some of the channels that we used back then. And now that I speak about this venture 15 years on, I would say what we were doing back then is basically e-commerce, as it is better known today. But having that very, very early start, I think even with the very limited and primitive tools that we had, was an exciting journey. Never could I foresee myself building tables in HTML and ensuring that alignment and everything is all nicely done, taking photos of the products and ensuring that the descriptions are well written in a concise manner, things like that, right? And then, of course, as a small business, we definitely face inventory tracking challenges because back in the day, there were no tools to help with all of this, right? Yeah, so that was how the journey started. And I am glad to say that it was one of the reasons why I was convinced that I didn't need a business degree back then to do business. Obviously, because I didn't have a business degree, the business couldn't scale very well, right? But I thought that was also a fun journey because we were, so what happened in terms of order fulfillment or last mile delivery, and it is better known today, is that we were literally taking two or three boxes of shoes and meeting customers at MRT stations and letting them try various sizes, right? Because people were not sure of their size, there was no proper return policy, and all of that, right? So again, for context, this was all 2007, and these were the things that we had to do in order to make the transactions work end to end, right? And
wait, so this is like a back in the day carousel.
Back in the
without the testing and trying.
I would say carousel per se, because carousel is more of like P2P. In this case, I would say it's more of a B2C kind of business. So this is early days of what? Amazon, early days of Shopee, early days of Lazada.
But you went the extra mile of letting them try the shoes, because I don't think Shopee or Amazon in early days would have done that, no?
Yeah, so this was also a learning point where back then, consumer trust in online transactions was non-existent, right? The fact that we had to conduct all these transactions face-to-face, it was always cash on delivery. Also because people didn't trust dealing online with people, right? You know, what guarantee do I have as a consumer back then? You know, if I pay, if I make a transfer to a bank account, how will I know if I will receive the goods? Right, so obviously the ecosystem has matured and come a long way, right? But I think these were the teething problems, and I'm glad that the big tech players or fellow crazy people around the world managed to solve this problem in very creative ways. And they definitely monetized that, so that's why people like Elon Musk and all that are where they are today, and people like me is still, you know, doing what I'm doing here, having this conversation with Joanna.
Doing amazing things. No, I think that's like an amazing journey. I always think about people of like 17, 18, like people who are in college. For me, I was just studying all the while. But at the same time, there's also people of your same age who are doing different things. If we went to college in the same year, I think I'll be like, wow, this person has a business. I think moving on, right, it's also like you started this before college. And I would say so after you graduated from college and you decided to venture into business, instead of finding a job like everybody would have.
So just wanted to clarify that. I did have a day job immediately upon graduation, and it was with a bank. I was just doing operations there. Didn't enjoy it. I wanted to move to a more customer-facing role, a front office role. But my interviews were pretty... I was pretty crappy at interviews, right? I'll just admit it. So that's why I didn't get any job offers. But I think that was also one of the reasons that gave me that motivation. And it was a catalyst for me to start my own thing, because if no one's going to hire me, fine, I'll just hire myself, right? And also to provide a bit of further context to that, when I was still studying at NUS, doing my engineering degree, I was very active in the student communities. So what happened back then was the club that I was in, they bought themselves, with the budget that we had, a digital camera.
Oh, wow.
Right? So that's how I started playing around with things. So back again though, to my fascination with playing around with equipment and technology and just seeing what that leads into. So I started playing around with a DSLR. back then in the day, and I was very fascinated by how a camera could still work despite being switched off. Yeah, so this was when DSLRs were new to the industry, film was on the decline, and digital was on the rise. Right, having had the chance to play around with cameras and taking photos for all the student events, people liked my photos, and they were always photos of people. And that was something I enjoyed. I always liked having a human subject in my photos. And eventually, I got invited to help to take photos at more and more events. So events that were even outside my student club. These also included, say, dance events. So that's how I also started my journey into taking photos for dance, which eventually also led me to taking photos for the sports, for sports clubs, right? So a bit of background. I used to be a sports person back in school many years ago.
Oh.
Yeah, so I've done a fair lot of crazy fun things. So one thing led to another. And I think all these different experiences in both the sports, taking photos for dance and all of that, it just made it easier for me to start taking photos and getting paid for them in a more professional manner.
Oh yeah, because you already have a portfolio.
In a way.
Yeah.
So that portfolio was already there. Back then, people were asking me, hey, why don't you try taking wedding photos and all that? So I held off for a long time about moving into the wedding industry because it's a very personal event. There are no do-overs. The risks are extremely high. Or in other words, there's no room for error.
Yeah.
If you mess up or you miss a specific moment,
then you get cancelled on social media.
So back then, social media was a thing, right? Thankfully. So I never wanted to move into that. So I did everything else first, corporate jobs.
Yeah.
Event job. I was invited to even do the media coverage for Team Singapore.
Oh.
Yeah, so it started by taking photos of S-League soccer club matches in over here, right, which was not as exciting as everything else, but I think everything happened for a reason. So for the sports scene, I started taking photos of S-League matches, and then people started to take notice. I got invited to take photos of yachting competitions. So these were some competitions organized by SMU. And I went on being invited to even say dragon boat kind of competitions. That these were organized by, I think, People's Association, the DBS Yacht Regatta. So all this exposure allowed me to build up the portfolio, which in turn allowed me to get even greater visibility. And that's where Team Singapore invited me to do coverage for the ASEAN University Games, which is one level below the SEA Games, where university athletes compete together. So the first of that happened, I believe, in 2012, I think. So this was shortly after quitting my banking job. I just started my own media company, and then this gig just came by, and I took it. So
Were you a solo person working on it, or did you have a team worked on it with you?
There was a team. Mm-hmm. So what happened was I provided photography coverage. There were other team members doing video coverage, editors and writers as well. So the deliverable from that was daily newsletter highlights.
Okay.
That will be published both internally and on the social media pages back then. So the 2012 games were held in Vientiane, which is the capital city of Laos. And over there, it felt like it's a little Olympic village. It's a really incredible place where you see every country would just set up residence in a block, which closely mimics our HDB estates here. But everyone, so just imagine these are top athletes in the prime of their life, super fit and all that, all coming from a diverse variety of backgrounds in ASEAN. So it was an amazing experience. You wake up, go for breakfast at the main cafeteria, and then you see the Thai volleyball team just doing the training next to you. And you see the Vietnamese soccer team just jogging around the area as they warm up, as they prep for the next few matches. So that was wow, I was in the middle of all these sporting champions in the region. And it was just such an amazing place to be.
Must have felt very, very surreal.
It was. Yeah. I think that's one of my most favorite experiences overseas. And then during the day-to-day coverage, it was also really hectic. We were taking the shuttle bus to jump from venue to venue. It's really almost as though I was a journalist for the Olympics, but at a regional level.
Yeah.
Right? Because at the end of the day, these are athletes who are still flying national colors.
Yeah.
They just probably haven't made it to the senior team, or some of them are senior team members, but they are just very, very young and still studying in school. So having to see like firsthand how other countries' athletes are progressing way faster than our Singaporean athletes is understandable because they devote so much time to training. Whereas our local athletes are balancing their studies with their sports trainings as well. To quote an example, I think the table tennis team, some of the students there were studying for their exams. I recall, I think one or two of them were from the medicine faculty. Yeah, and that's, that also explains why their exam timetable is a bit different from the rest of the undergraduates.
Yeah.
Right. So in between tournaments, this guy was like taking up his like giant medicine
textbook
and like flipping through the pages and highlighting stuff because he had exams to prepare for the moment he returned to Singapore.
Wow, but he's also a sportsman.
Yeah, he's also a sportsman at the same time, right? So that's quite incredible. And then at the same time, you could contrast this with the table tennis teams from other countries.
Yeah.
These guys just devote 90% of their time to training.
Mm.
And the other 10% is like for studies. And some of them even redo certain years because they just couldn't make the grade, but they're happy to represent the country anyway.
I have a question about that. Like, since you have seen two different types of, like, that's a comparison, right? Do you think it's better to kind of like be a generalist? Like you are able to study, you are able to do sports, but maybe this person who did it was really good at it. But for most of us, right, we are just like generalists, right? Jack of all trades. But also there's someone who dedicates like 90% of their time to just one thing. He's like a specialist. Which one do you think works better?
Being a generalist versus a specialist. I think I say this in the context of life in Singapore. And also to sort of frame this in a more career-driven aspect, right?
Mm.
Because, again, in Singapore, career is such a big thing.
Mm.
I would say being a specialist with a variety of skill sets.
Mm.
So, to clarify, being a specialist in one or two things, but yet having the breadth of knowledge in other areas as well would be beneficial for most people in the long run. So it's what they call the T-shaped kind of profile, right?
Mm.
Where you can sort of do a few things, but you're exceptionally skilled or experienced in one or two of them.
Mm.
And the reason why I think this works for most of us here is that people recognize us for that one or two core skills that we have, right? And at the same time, we are independent enough to be able to adapt to the needs of different situations.
Mm-hmm.
While still maintaining that one or two core competencies.
Mm.
So that's where the breadth of knowledge and experience and abilities will come in handy.
Mm.
Right? So for example, let's just say in your case, like as let's say Joanna.
Yeah.
Joanna is great at hosting such talks or these sessions or podcasts in general.
Mm.
Right? She's great at people relations. She's great at managing stakeholders. But at the same time, she also knows a little bit about IT. Right, so that's how she's able to cut and edit all these pieces of recordings and piece them together and publish them for a wider audience.
Mm.
Right, so even though that IT or publishing aspect might not be her core competency, but that's useful in allowing this podcast series to be successful.
Mm.
Right, so that's one example.
That's a good example. Yeah, thanks for using me as an example.
I guess it's very relatable.
Yeah, I would say so, but I'm also very, very curious because just now you mentioned that you didn't want to get into wedding photography, which means you got into it in the end.
Eventually,
so yeah. What was that turning point that say that, okay, now I think I'm confident enough to do it?
Great question. So in the context of the business, so I was sitting down, just running through the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I think having that data-driven approach to driving strategic decisions matter. Because I was realizing that, hey, I put in so much hours to produce this amount of work, but the amount of revenue that the company is generating is just this much, right? So what this meant was that the margin per hour wasn't very high. How could we scale things up? How could we do things better? How could we bring in more revenue for the firm, right? So at the same time, besides running all these corporate accounts and doing the corporate contracts, I was already doing a bit of weddings as not the main photographer, but as a side or second photographer, if you could put it that way, just to get a taste of what it was like and just to continue expanding my variety of skill sets.
Mm-hmm.
It started off by helping friends and people I know to just shoot for free, right? So that allowed me to build up my portfolio with minimal risk or chance of messing up, to put it across that way. So at the same time, I researched very deeply into what was required to not say make the switch, but what was required of, say, doing weddings, right? So there was a lot of research done. I was reading through forums, talking to people. And it was only because of all of that that I thought, okay, maybe it's worth a shot. So for context, in the case of weddings, I would say the contracts that came in terms of monetary amount was a lot higher than the corporate ones, right? And it was something that allowed me to explore a more creative side to the work itself. And I think once I started making that migration, of course, in hindsight, there are always pros and cons to both, right? But I think, let me just quickly touch on the two. So I think the difference between doing B2B, which is the corporate contracts, and B2C, is that the good thing about B2B is that it's recurring in nature. There is some element of having repeat business, which I would say is beneficial in the long run as well. The challenge there is to find a way to sort of move up the ladder in terms of increasing the contract size so that you're able to ensure that your monthly revenues are sensible enough for the amount of time you invest in. Right? Whereas for B2C, which weddings would be classified under, with the benefit of hindsight, I'm able to make sense of why a single wedding contract pays so much, because there's a lot of work that goes unseen after the event is completed, and that's post-production. But before I go into that, I just want to make sure that I had sufficiently addressed the point earlier about making the transition. So the transition wasn't overnight. It was something that was built up gradually along the site, doing a lot of homework and research and building up the confidence and the portfolio to ensure that I can deliver well when I made that pivot over to do more B2C kind of business.
And which one would you prefer?
Which one would I prefer?
Yeah.
That's a very good question.
I would say, like, for example, I would think that B2B, you kind of have a bit of structure, right? Like, you go into this event, you know what's already happening. Even though for weddings, you know what's happening, but weddings are usually more flexible in that way, and it runs on emotions. Even when you're taking the photos yourself, like, as an artsy person, you also feel that emotion, right?
Yeah, okay, so for context, and I say this as a former creative, right?
Yeah.
So B2B, the issue with that is there's a lot less creative freedom. A lot of the times you're taking the very standard shots. There's only so much creative angle you can do. Taking group photos for the event participants, prize award giving ceremonies, the very standard stuff that I didn't really enjoy as a creative, but it sort of helped to pay the bills, right? Whereas for, say, the B2C kind of portfolio, that's where every request is different, every wedding is different, every pre-wedding is also different. I'll elaborate on that a bit more later on. With that, with the B2C port, it's always about doing something new. It's always very refreshing, it's very exciting to discover new environments, new situations. Also gave me the chance to challenge myself in terms of how do you create good work even when the external environment can be very challenging. So things like being stuck in a tiny three-room HDB flat with extremely poor lighting, how do you still get the shots out? Right? How do you still make it worth a memory that people can look back in, you know, 10, 20 years down the road? So things like that stretched my creative muscle, and it allowed me to, I think, produce some very memorable kind of works. Right, so that's for weddings. For pre-weddings, I think the amount of creativity is also unparalleled. Not only did I shoot locally, I was able to shoot overseas as well. So that gave me the chance to travel very frequently to, I would say, exotic places. So these would be like your major cities in Europe, Paris, London, Munich, I've been there, Australia, Sydney, Perth, Melbourne, beautiful places, even like North Asia, right? So places like Japan, Hong Kong. In fact, my first foray to Tokyo was extremely memorable for me, because as a kid, I've always liked the Japanese culture. I was exposed to the music very early on, enjoying the food and all that. So being on this self-employed entrepreneur kind of journey allowed me to expand and explore that creative, the discovery portion, and traveling abroad and experiencing all these new sights and sounds, but still with a very business focus at the end of the day. So while I would say it sounds like and it seems like a very glamorous lifestyle, when I look back at some of my old Instagram posts, I kind of feel embarrassed to the point where I'm saying stuff like, I'm taking the plane more than I'm taking the train. And that was really pretty true in, I think, 2015 or 2016, mm-hmm. which was where I would say the business probably peaked.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were times where I was just flying in and out of the country week on week, back to back. I remember there was a time in Tokyo where I was like preparing for an assignment and I was already booking the next few tickets to Europe in the coming months because there was another assignment waiting for me there and I had to do the bookings early. So that's just the kind of pace and intensity that
mm-hmm.
I think looking back was exciting, but it was also very tiring.
Mm.
Right? And I think that it's also important to also shed some light on the challenges of running a business because you're always, or I was very concerned about ensuring that no client safety, client data, all that was well preserved.
Mm.
So back then, I think cloud storage was still in its infancy. Uploading 30 gigabytes of data into the cloud in 2015 was not very cheap. So everything was determined by hard drives and saving, having backups of your backups, essentially.
Yeah.
And then I never really felt safe until I returned back to Singapore. So the context to this was every time I'm overseas, I'm always on guard. I have to ensure that my equipment doesn't get stolen because they are expensive equipment. And I think in Asia, it's still not too bad. But in places like Europe...
You get pickpocketed. You just look away and something gets missing.
Exactly, right? It's scary that way. And then I'm traveling with 3 luggages and ensuring that, you know, how do I take care of all these barang-barang while ensuring that I make it back to my home country in a safe place? So that was also...
Yeah, and if you save everything in your hard drive, which means that if your hard drive is lost, you're essentially gone.
Yeah, so to mitigate that, I always ensure that I have backups, right? So so let's say I always have one hard drive in each luggage that I have and I have another copy in my hand carry, right? So no matter what, you know, all that data is safe.
Yeah.
But that was also the kind of, I think, unseen stress that I always had at the back of my head, right? So I think going forward, all of these sort of took its toll on me, on my health as well. And I think maybe the next natural question that you would have is, you know, why did I choose to step away from the business?
Yeah.
Right? So I guess this all accumulated in the exhaustion and me neglecting my health.
Mm.
And in 2017, that's where I fell really, really sick. Mm. So what happened was it was the middle of the year as well. It was a great year. But at the back of my head, I knew that, you know, having been doing this business for the past 5-6 years, how can I pivot to something that's a bit more sustainable? At this point of time, I wasn't looking to move back into a corporate job.
Mm-hmm.
I was just maybe thinking of what can I do differently in the business? Like, must it always be photography? Can we expand into offering more videography services or things like that? Right. But all of that came to a halt where I came down with this really, really bad cough. I was coughing nonstop for like 6 weeks.
Okay.
Right, to the point where my sleep was getting affected. I was coughing so badly that I had no choice but to see a doctor because I'm the stubborn type. You know, I'm the kind where I will just not seek medical attention until it's really, really bad. So for context, I went to see like the GP downstairs my place. He gave me some antibiotics. It stopped working after 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then my mom told me to go and see like a traditional Chinese doctor, which I also went to. Took some herbs and medication, stopped being effective after 2 weeks. I went back to the same GP again. And he said, dude, go and get a chest x-ray if you can, just to be safe, right? And this still happened in June, I remember very clearly. And I asked all my doctor friends, like, you know, hey, where's the fastest place where I can get an x-ray done without having to, like, say, queue up at a polyclinic?
Yeah.
Right, so I just went straight to the private hospital. So I believe this was Gleneagles back then, because it was the nearest one to my place.
Mm.
So long story short, I went in, got my x-ray, went to see the A&E doctor. I asked him, doc, what's wrong with me? Why am I coughing so badly? What's the results? Right. So he said, I think I need to refer you to a specialist.
That sounds really bad.
I mean, I had no idea. Right. So thankfully, I was in a private hospital where I didn't have to endure any long queues. I was able to book an appointment with a specialist doctor on the same day within the next hour or two. Yeah, I went up to the specialist clinic. He sat me down and he upfront told me that, dude, you have cancer. But the good news is that this is a very treatable form. Our prime minister had it before. He got treatment. He's okay before getting his second diagnosis, which was a different form of cancer, which is also recovered from. But to sort of elevate my concerns is that treatment options were really good. and it's a positive outlook for me. Right? But this hit me like a truck because I'm like, what the heck did I do here? So I wasn't prepared for any of this. Immediately, I texted my same doctor friend and asked her, like, hey, is there like someone else I could ask or another doctor I could see? And it turned out that she was able to give me some context. And immediately, I set up another session with another specialist in the same hospital on the same day, just to get a second opinion, right? So thankfully, I like my second doctor a lot better. He said, okay, look, let's do a more step-by-step diagnosis based on the x-ray itself. It's a bit early to come to any conclusion, but you know, he felt that it could be another growth in my thyroid or thyroid-related growth, right? You know, but let's do a more detailed scan the following day, which he managed to set up very thankfully. And the next thing I did was to call up my insurance agent and say, dude, I have a hospital insurance. How do we get the paperwork done? What do we need to do? Right. So long story short, I went for my CT scan the next day and my second specialist referred me to his surgeon. So this happened on a Wednesday. CT scan happened on a Thursday. I was warded immediately. My surgeon came in. He said, look, we need to do a biopsy, which was to basically get tissue sample to really determine what kind of medical issue we're dealing with here, right? Because there's a massive growth in my chest area and that's definitely not normal. My surgeon suspects that it could be lymphoma, which is a form of cancer, and we need to move swiftly and decisively, right? So this happened in the midst of a very, very packed Q3 for 2017. The next thing I had to do was to, before I even had to do it, I asked my surgeon, like, you know, is it possible to like delay the surgery by a month? Because, you know, I have assignments coming. I have contracts. I have business contracts to fulfill. And he was like, no, push all them away. This thing is serious shit that we're dealing with right now. And how I knew that it was a very serious thing was because on Thursday night, this was the second night of me seeking medical attention, I realized I was starting to lose my voice. I had trouble speaking. Not that I couldn't speak, but the projection was just not there. And what was suggested was that this loss of voice is very common among patients who have growths in their chest cavity because the growth sort of presses on the nerves that affects the vocal cords. Right, so this was, I would say, a telltale sign that, you know, what I was dealing with at that point of time was very, very serious. So immediately, I had to act very quickly and decisively, right? So I sent out an SOS. I was pinging all my contacts in the industry, say, hey, look, I need to find stand-ins for the next few projects in very, very short notice. Let me know how I can link it up with them. Payment's not an issue. I'll do with all of that, right? So I had to handle the business side of things very, very quickly. At the same time, on a personal level, I had to make arrangements with my family to let them know about, okay, this is what to do in the event that I do not wake up from the surgery, right? So somehow I just had this very peaceful, or I was very calm in making all these decisions. It was very rational thoughts that I had, because to me, I was like, okay, there's an emergency, but to deal with this, I need to take care of my business first. I need to take care of my family first. I need to get my personal affairs sorted. Right. So I took out my laptop in hospital, started typing out to-do lists for every single one. Right. And I think going through that gave me the peace of mind to go into surgery the next day with the right spirits. And of course, I invited my close friends to come and visit me in hospital. And I think that sort of like helped me feel better about the whole thing. Complexities of the surgery was that I was awake throughout the whole procedure. They gave me local anesthesia. I couldn't be put to sleep. They couldn't give me GA because the complexity of the growth was such that if my surgeon put me to sleep, my body muscles were relaxed and there's nothing left to sort of prevent the tumor from pressing down on all my vital organs, right? So what we knew at the point of time before the surgery from the CT scans and the x-ray was that I had a massive growth which measured, 15 by 6 by 3 cm? For context, that's the size of your McDonald's box. No, your Filet-O-Fish box opened up all the way. So yeah, that's the kind of size we're dealing with. And that was in my chest. I didn't feel a thing because apparently there are no nerve endings in your chest, right? that was passing down all my soft organs, which also included like my the superior vena cava that leads to my heart. It was passing down on my windpipe. Yeah, and affecting my vocal cords. So it's either I suffocate to death or I don't get blood going into my heart. Right. So for those who are not so medically inclined, if the major vein that travels to your heart doesn't get any blood, that's not good. Right. Separately, my windpipe was also being compressed to the point where it looked pretty nasty on the CT scan. Yeah, those were like the two major concerns. And the cough was apparently due to pneumonia, which I also had on the side. So if it wasn't for the cough, I wouldn't have found out about this massive growth. Yeah, but now I think one of the other symptoms which I didn't pay attention to was I was losing weight very, very quickly. But at the same time, this coincided with a change in my diet, which was for me cutting down on my carbs and cutting down my sugary drinks. I basically switched from Milo Peng at my favorite kopitiam store to like drinking barley. So I thought like, wow, this diet is going incredibly well. I'm like losing like, you know, 2-4 kg in a period of months. To the point where my friends were starting to ask me, Ned, I think you're losing a bit too much weight. Like, you know, can you start eating more? I'm still eating chicken rice. Because my logic was that that's my protein and all that. I'm cutting away from cai fan because cai fan is not very healthy. But I digress. So all these things happened in that span and combined with the stresses I had from work. And it accumulated with me falling really, really damn bloody sick. Right. So fast forward to the day of the surgery. Basically, I passed out, and the next thing I knew when I woke up, it was 3 days later and I was in ICU. Yeah, I basically had tubes sticking out of all my body, and yeah, judging from Joanna's face right now, I will not delve too much into detail, right? But basically, I spent 2 weeks in ICU. I had already received my first dose of chemotherapy treatment back then because I signed a disclaimer saying that I gave my doctors free rein to do whatever they could to save my life, and they did, thankfully. Because if not, I would not have made it out from the operating theatre. But yeah, Joanna's probably going to slap me for now for saying all of this.
Sorry.
So that was the kind of trauma that I went through, but I think it's one of the most life-changing parts of my life, because I think those 11 days, those 2 weeks in ICU was where I learned so much about the world. I learned so much about myself. I learned that you actually don't need a lot to be happy. There's so much that we take for granted in this day and age, and especially when we live in a modern city like Singapore, right? It's so easy to get lost in all the material chase. And there I was sitting in my ICU bed, not being able to speak because I had a massive tube being stuck down my throat, because without that I would not be able to breathe. But my mind was still sharp, but my physical body was in extremely poor condition. I looked at my legs, right, and like my leg muscles were just atrophied. I looked like a grandpa, right, because I was just stationary for 3 days, and the body is really efficient at getting rid of muscle that you need to use at any one point of time. I could still write. I had to write because the context was I couldn't use my phone because I had lost dexterity in my fingers. But I could still hold a pen and write, even though the handwriting was not legible, barely legible. But I think the key learnings that I had was that, you know, looking out of the window was the best thing ever, right? Because I realized at that point of time that the best TV screen or the best digital screen that you have can never replace that window in your room and looking out through my eyes, my own human eyes, and just enjoying the sights of nature outside, right? And the context was, Gleneagles Hospital is situated next to the Botanical Gardens. And I think knowing that there are people out there going about their daily commutes, or even other patients who are going to the park for walks just to get some sense of normalcy, is something that was very, very touching to me. Yeah. And suddenly, like, you know, what's important in life at that point of time? To me, what was important was being able to still enjoy the sight of the window next to my bed, being able to still breathe normally, not choke on my own phlegm, being able to get some relief by drinking water because my throat was just dry and parched. I still recall the very, very painful experience when my surgeon had to remove my breathing tube from my throat, because that was a very necessary step for me in terms of my road to recovery, right? But at the same time, as much as all this sounds very scary, but there are so many small wins along the way that just makes me appreciate the day-to-day things that all of us take for granted. So one eventful piece that I would like to share is when my speech therapist came into the ICU room, right? So her objective was to determine whether my body, and more importantly, my throat, was able to take solid food again.
Mm.
But before we had to go to that, she had to like let me test out by eating biscuits.
Mm.
And this is like not even anything flavorful or any spectacular biscuit. It's just like your normal Jacob or Kong Guan biscuit, right? They comes in a very small packet with just two pieces inside.
Mm.
To ease me into that, she broke off a very, very small piece, dipped it in water, and let me just try a very, very small bite, right? So the first bite went well. It was very uneventful. I was able to swallow the very soft pieces of biscuit, which tasted more like bread dipped in water at that point of time, right? Because it was soaked through. And then I was adventurous, I was brave, and I asked my speech therapist, can I try the one without dunking it in water? Like, just let me try the raw biscuit by itself.
Mm.
Right? And when she handed me that biscuit, that cracker, that plain oatmeal or wholemeal cracker, right, that just seems so ordinary. The moment I put it in my mouth, after 1 week of not having solid food, it was an explosion of flavor that was just going around. Like, it tasted like I was having pizza, right? I freaking kid you not. Like, my first bite of an ordinary wholemeal biscuit tasted like pizza to me, right? And that's because I was deprived from any kind of food intake for one entire week. And suddenly, I realized that actually the kind of food that we consume on a day-to-day basis is extremely over-seasoned. And there's a good reason for that, right? Because business, I mean, your typical businesses want out there, your Bak Kut Teh stores want you to go back for week on week just to enjoy the food. But, you know, the point of hospital food in a hospital is just to ensure that it's healthy enough for you to get better.
Mm.
That experience of eating again was amazing. And I think even the ability to walk from the bedside to the sink in the room, that was something that wasn't easy for me at all. I think just standing up and balancing on my two feet, on my two legs, which I hadn't used for a week, I had to learn how to walk again from scratch, right? I think the nurse was very kind. She was like just making sure, hand-holding me all the way. But even before it came to that, I think it started for me just standing up for 10 seconds and sitting back down on the bed. That was the first step that I took before I was even given the green light to try walking 3 steps to a chair in the room, which was just 2 meters away. So I think learning how to walk again, learning how to brush my own teeth, learning how to basically be able to shower myself. So these were milestones as part of my recovery journey that I needed to achieve before my doctors were able to graduate me from the ICU ward back to a normal ward to be moved out of the ICU. So I spent another month in hospital before I was able to be discharged, and I continued receiving treatment for 6 months in and out of hospital, right? And I think that itself is also quite a journey that I think might be a bit out of scope and out of time for today's session. But I think the main message is moving from strength to strength, while also being mindful of everything that we have today that we kind of very shamefully already take for granted for.
Mm.
Right. So I think it's one thing for me to share this. I mean, I'm hoping that, you know, the audience who's listening in at this to this message at some point of time, I think even being able to suspend a minute or two and just be grateful for everything that you have today, I think that would mean a lot to all of us, just to keep us grounded, right? Mm. But I think on a brighter note, I think even the recovery journey that I had is something that I also like to share, because obviously I took time off from work, took time off from my business, just to get back into shape, get back into health, not just because of my ICU journey, but because cancer treatment does take a very tough toll on the body. Mm. Thankfully, in today's day and age, medical technology has progressed to the point where I didn't throw up at all, even though I did feel quite nauseous towards the end as the treatment sort of ramped up. But yeah, I think going through losing all my hair, going through having to wear a mask when I was going outdoors just to go about my day-to-day life and get some sunshine, I think going from all of that to be able to sort of like jog around my estate, this little park just downstairs my place, I started just doing 400 meter laps around, even climbing the overhead bridge just to get to the other side of the road was an achievement for me. But I think it allowed me to slowly build back my fitness to the point where I gave myself a goal of like, hey, why not let's use this time and start training for a triathlon, right? Because I used to be a sports person when I was in school, and I wanted to be able to, I think, do a crazy event like a triathlon, because when I was younger, that's something that I always dreamed about. One of the reasons why I was very reluctant to start it back when I was younger was because I'm a very weak swimmer, right? So despite all of that, I told myself, okay, I'm going to start training for a triathlon. Thankfully, I had a friend who was also sort of like on the same fitness journey, and he took on triathlon as a way of improving his health. And I decided to follow in his footsteps, and he was very generous in being able to be my coach in that sense of like teaching me how to swim properly, do my freestyle strokes properly, so that, you know, I don't tire out after 50 meters. Yeah, so that went on for I guess most of 2018. I think the human body is also quite amazing that it can also get back to shape very, very quickly, so long as you're able to put in the time and the effort to do that. So I think at the end of 2018, yeah, I think I was able to complete my first Olympic distance triathlon in December, right? And of course, I think also for context, that wasn't my first event. I started off with the smaller events, definitely. I think over the course of 3 to 4 months. And I think all of that helped me build up the fitness, the strength, and the courage to take on bigger and bigger goals. And I didn't just stop at one triathlon. I think in 2019, I continued on this journey by participating in subsequent triathlon events, both in Singapore and in the region. And I think how seeing all of this came back full circle, I think falling sick was the best thing that could have happened to me, because not only was it the perfect excuse for me to like wind down the business, I think it also gave me a new perspective in life on how to be a better person, what are the things that really matter. And I think learning how to treat others with dignity and respect, because at a point of time, I realized that I think even the hospital staff, the healthcare workers who just spent so much time and energy just ensuring that I was being able to be nursed back to health is something that I was so appreciative for, to the point where I think even for the subsequent 2 years, I went back, I think every, was it Christmas or Chinese New Year, just to give them some goodies, just to showcase my appreciation for the healthcare workers, because even if it's the festive season, they are still putting so much time and energy and effort in helping the patients recover. And I wanted to show my appreciation for them, for all their hard work.
It's so difficult to put into words whatever you have shared in the past, like maybe 20 minutes or so. But something that you pointed out was really what we tend to forget in life when we start to rush for certain things, right? I think all of us have desires. We are taught to chase after certain things, or we have certain things that we want to achieve. And we always think that when we are at a younger age, we have a lot of time, we have a lot of energy to do whatever we need to do. Because as we kind of get older, it's also when people tell you, right, like your body gets weaker, you start not being able to do certain things. So the advice that was always given to us was that when you're younger, you should push more. But I think what you shared today really gave another perspective on how much of a limit we should set for that. I mean, I can't really speak for your experience. I've just been listening, right? But I had no idea that before we were going to do this podcast, when you mentioned about your health, you had this experience before. I didn't know that it was going to be so heavy. But I'm just very grateful that you shared that. It's a wake-up call for some of us, but also something to keep in mind for people who are already on that journey, right, of like recovering. I think that's something for us to think about.
Yeah, definitely. I think maybe to help people understand the milestones a bit better, I started the first e-commerce business when I was 21. I think, yes, I was 21 back then. I started the second business when I was 25, 26. And I fell sick when I was, I think, 30, going on 31. And this year, this year I'm 36, right? So that's the kind of context that we're looking at.
I'm just very grateful for what you shared. I don't think any words can really explain what I feel right now or what other people might feel. I haven't been through illnesses like this, but I think watching my family members who have also been through such life-threatening illnesses just 2-3 years ago, it really gave me a different perspective to what I really want to achieve in life. Is it really in career, or is it something in life that I've always wanted to do and I haven't started doing? Yeah, so I think that's also something to really assemble the thoughts and also to come back to look within yourself, right? You know, you took such a long time for recovery and the business has started to wind down. I think in a sense also corporate for a lot of people, and especially a lot of young people these days who went into corporate and now they are in freelancing. And now because of COVID, it's also the era of like people freelancing, right? So in that sense, like people quit corporate because, you know, it's also a toll on the body. It's like rushing from 9 to 5 every day. So what made you have the thought of like, maybe I could try corporate again?
I think why would I try corporate again is because I was able to enjoy and experience the entrepreneur life when I was younger, when I didn't have as many liabilities. I think back when I was 25, 26, that was it was a right time for me to take risk, because no matter what, I still had my engineering degree at the back of my mind. I did spend a year in the bank. In the worst case, I could always just go back, right? But of course, I faced a different set of challenges moving into corporate, precisely because I didn't have a very strong corporate background. And not many people recognize that entrepreneur journey that I had, because it's just unique. It doesn't fit in the corporate mold. But there's a different set of challenges for anyone who wants to hear that transition, right? I think maybe if the question is about, should I move into corporate and should I start my own entrepreneur journey? Right? I think to answer that question, ultimately, I would say the grass always seems greener. There's always going to be a different set of trade-offs when you are responsible for your income, when you are responsible for your own revenue, and when you're responsible for the livelihoods of the people you hire. So with that comes along its own set of responsibilities and challenges that I would say, give it a try. I think it's always great for people to come out and do something on their own just to get a taste of how it is, right? And I think for those who have already have had very established corporate careers, I would say you guys are in a much stronger position than I am, because it's in the event that the business doesn't work out, right? And 95% of businesses don't work out, or at least they don't last between they don't last beyond 2 or 5 years, right? So the statistics can prove that. But I think give it a try. If it doesn't work, go back to corporate. That's fine. At least at the end of the day, you're able to be accountable to yourself and say, hey, look, I gave it a try. It was great. It was fun. It worked. It didn't work out. It's okay. At least you gave it a try. Of course, it's going to be scary. Of course, at this point of time, given your respective ages, given your families, your kids, your other obligations that you have to take care of, those will weigh in very, very heavily in your decision-making process. And I think given the benefit of wisdom that I'm sure anyone who is not 25 years old but a lot older would probably have. I think it would definitely help with the planning and ensuring that, you know, you have an exit strategy.
Mm.
Right? What's going to happen if things don't work out? Right? Or when things don't work out? Right? I think maybe once you have that in place and once you have that planned out, for me, I didn't necessarily have that planned out when I started my own journey.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a piece of advice I would give anyone who is looking to start their own is to always have, or rather, to always start with the end in mind.
Mm.
Right? So that you're able to sort of close the chapter and move on as smoothly as possible.
Mm.
When that day eventually comes. It might come in the next 2 months, the next 20 months, the next 20 years. I don't know how successful your businesses will be, right? But of course, I wish everyone the best of luck if you do want to go on this journey. Yeah, and happy to sort of share any pieces of advice or help if it's relevant to any of you.
So how's corporate treating you now? How's corporate life for you?
How's corporate life for me? I think it's exciting to be back.
Because it's been more than 10 years, right? Since you have been in this position. Like, the lifestyle, going into offices. How has it changed for you? Like, maybe your experience, your thinking, maybe?
Experience and thinking. I would say the experience here at Google is very different from elsewhere.
Mm.
Right? I believe in some ways, Google acts like a startup. In some ways, it's still corporate.
Mm.
I would say, personally, having had the experiences from both sides,
mm-hmm.
right, I think I'm in a very comfortable place where I'm able to sort of navigate the kind of mindset shifts
mm-hmm.
when it comes to work here at Google. So I can deal with the ambiguity, the challenges, and the kind of opportunities that I will have to seize in order to be successful here,
mm-hmm.
while at the same time also ensuring that, you know, the corporate stakeholders, internally and externally, that their needs are being met,
mm.
their needs are being heard first and foremost, so that you can meet those needs.
Mm.
So for me, it doesn't feel too difficult. I would say maybe learning where to draw a line between having a clear division between work and personal life, I think that's really important. And I think that's something that I'm still learning to pick up or get better at. But I would say maybe for a place that's as demanding and high performance like Google, I think it's always being in the flow.
Mm.
I would say it's definitely recommended to really switch off from work,
mm-hmm.
because those breaks are required for your mental well-being and health.
Mm.
Right? But at the same time, sometimes inspiration just hits you in the middle of the night when you're in the wash. You're in the bathroom, like having shower thoughts and be like, hey, actually, I could do this better.
Yeah, for sure.
And I make a point to like just take out my phone very quickly, once I'm out of the shower, of course, to just jot down a few lines and, you know, like, just leave it at that, because this is how things flow. I'm not saying that this is the best way to work. I don't think I'm the best person to be an advocate for work-life balance. I'm still trying to find that, but I think having had the chance to be on both sides of the coin allows me to see things from a different perspective, and I think I would try to encourage everyone to at least experience that side hustle or that business aspect or entrepreneur journey in more ways than ever. And I think in today's world, in 2022, we have an amazing abundance of tools for anyone to just literally pick up a phone and start a business. You don't even need a laptop anymore, right? You have, so exactly. And you don't need me to start talking about the opportunities available on Instagram or TikTok.
I think people these days know better, right? Like, even on TikTok, you can start a shop.
Yeah, so go out and do something. Do it. I think now is the best time. If not now, then when?
No, but thank you so much for what you shared today. Like I said, I really didn't expect us to go into such deep conversation. It's for the better though. It caught me by surprise, but it's a good surprise in a way. And I think moving back to what you said about always having an end in mind, I think it works not only just for businesses, but also in everything that you're really passionate about or things that you really want to do. So thank you so much today, Ned.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, not at all. And if anybody who's listening wants to reach out to Ned, I think he's always open for it. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Just slide into my DMs. So, yes.
Using, what is that, Gen Z language or is that millennial language?
Well, I'm classified as a millennial, so.
Okay, I'm in the middle of both, so I can't really speak much about that. All right, that's all.